Saving money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
For exclusive podcasts and more, sign up at patreon.com/partnersincrimemedia.
This week's Law & Order Marathon winner is Britt Kahn of Portland, Oregon. Britt will get a marathon decal showing she watched 26.2 hours of her favorite crime show. To be next week's winner, sign up at lawandorderpodcast.com.
I'm Kevin Flynn with Rebecca Lavoy and Brady Carlson, and these are their stories.
You think you know who did it, but you don't know who did it. Law and Order, Law and Order, Law and Order. It's no ordinary police procedural, baby. It's the FNOG of police procedures, baby. Law and Order, Law and Order, Law and Order, Law and Order. These are their stories, these are their stories.
Welcome to These Are Their Stories, the podcast about network TV's most enduring crime franchise and the real-life cases that inspired their shows. I'm Kevin Flynn. Each podcast will break down an episode from either Criminal Intent, SVU, or Original Recipe. And today we're looking at Law & Order Season 3, Episode 8, Prince of Darkness.
If Manuel goes belly up, Elvis is on the next plane home.
Manuel dies, you prop him up, put a piano in front of him. Nobody knows about this. I want two uniforms on his door.
Joining me to do just that is true crime author and the host of Crime Writers On and Netflix's You Can't Make This Up podcast, Rebecca Lavoy. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, Kevin. That's not my real name, but that's the one I'm going with today.
All right. So that's a reference I guess we'll get later.
Yes.
Rebecca, always doing the inside jokes.
Always.
Always.
I don't care about the audience at all.
And rounding out our panel is our special guest. On his fourth appearance.
Holy shit.
From the cool, weird, awesome podcast and Wisconsin Public Radio, it's Brady Carlson. Hi, Brady.
Hello, but you can call me Elvis just for this one show.
Elvis. a Colombian hitman named Elvis. Yes.
A young Elvis.
You're not giving him shit about doing the fake name right now.
It's all out the window at this point, I guess. I've lost control.
We're hijacking your show.
30 seconds into it. Okay. Brady, you know, congratulations on joining the four-timer club. You and Sarah D. Bunting are the only two who have so been appointed.
It has really made all of the sacrifices of the last 16 months worth it to hear you say that. Four times.
So if I could drop you in as an extra or a witness in any Law & Order episode, any scene, what would it be?
I would be best as one of the people early on in a Law & Order episode who can't help the detectives and will actually say the words, "I'm sorry, I had the flu that night, and also some guy was pressing on my optic nerve, so I didn't see the guy who started the fire that ended up killing the mayor's mistress. I can't help
it." Yeah, well, you can't just say that line. You also have to be doing something.
Yes.
So what do you think it would be? Would you be a fishmonger? Would you...
Retail worker folding sweaters.
Would you be a window washer on the 30th floor?
A doorman hosing off the sidewalk.
That'd be a great one. You could be, like, they could be inside and you could be outside the window with the squeegee.
A squeegee guy would sort of fit my own personal idiom, I think. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I can't help you guys.
Wait, what? What's that, sir?
I said I can't help you.
Brady, remind us of all the franchises. Which two cops are your favorite detective team?
Favorite Law and Order detective team.
I am always for Lenny Briscoe. He is the man and always will be. I'm partial, I believe, to Briscoe and Logan, sort of the original odd couple that is actually on the same page almost all the time.
But you can be swayed to Briscoe and Green if I sit on your chest, right?
I can be, yeah.
I knew it. I knew it.
Yeah.
No, his backup go-to is Lupo and Bernard, actually.
Yes.
I loved Lupo and Bernard. And every time I see a promo for Black-ish or any of those cell phone commercials that Anthony Anderson does now, I go back to Lupo and Bernard. I mean, I'm just loving that.
And who's your favorite prosecutorial team?
Favorite Law and Order district attorney prosecutorial team.
It's got to be the Lovebirds. You know, it's hang 'em high, Jack McCoy, and Claire Kincaid, may she rest in peace. Nobody could make a concerned look in the middle of a courtroom conversation that wasn't going quite right as Claire Kincaid could. You know, if Facts. McCoy wasn't getting the witness to say what the witness was supposed to be saying, she'd just come in there with that concerned look, and they'd have the head and shoulders shot right up tight on her. And you just knew everything was going to hell.
You knew the shoulder shot was happening because you could see all the shoulder pads in the shot.
And now let's take a look at the first half of this episode, Law & Order Season 3, Episode 8, Prince of Darkness. Manuel and Natalie Ortega and their daughter Felice are enjoying a wonderful restaurant until they aren't. A hitman sprays their table with bullets, killing Natalie and leaving Manuel clinging to life.
He came in the back door. Well, I mean, he came in from the kitchen. No, he descended from heaven on a silver chariot.
Room full of people, guy comes in, he fires. Is he sending a message?
I did it to them, I can do it to you. Close your eyes, keep your mouth shut.
Young Felice has been taken in by her Colombian grandmother, who insists Manuel is a legitimate travel agent and has nothing to do with the drug trade. He just books lots of trips to South America. At Manuel's apartment, Logan and Soretta find a rare .38 Derringer, the kind used in a recent hit on a Colombian drug dealer. Cragen remembers the feds issuing a warning about a hitman named Gaitan coming to New York for an unknown target. Did Manuel take out a cartel drug dealer, then a cartel hitman come to take out Manuel? Well, trouble is Manuel is still alive, so Gaitan is going to stick around the city until the job's done. Manuel's partner Ramon admits to arranging Gaitan's travel and putting him up in a hotel. He's already checked out, but the detectives learn he made a phone call to his local booty call, Sandra. After Logan gets a call from the world's biggest cell phone, they arrest him, returning to Sandra's place. He tells the cops that his name is Paulo Esteban, not Javier Gaitan. After some bullshit hearing about international indictments, Stone and Robinette are given 4 days to prove he's Gaitan and connected to the shooting. Soretta gets in touch with a gun dealer who likely sold Gaitan a special left-handed machine gun used in the hit. They called it the Paul McCartney version. They set up a sting to nab George Lebrano and get him to testify. But during the undercover buy, Lebrano gets antsy about the price and shoots Detective Phil Soretta in the stomach. Well, I wish I was at the casting call for the role of Felice Ortega, because it would have been 6 hours of little girl screaming mommy.
Mommy, no! Mommy, no! Oh, I know. But what about the casting call for the wife? I mean, it's just a bunch of Karens talking about how they don't want to move to a country with brown people. I mean, I really did feel for the daughter and the dad at that dinner, because mom was just like, listen, Belize was nice, but I don't want to be around those people all the time.
And her husband's like, what do you mean, those people?
I want to talk about the people working in the back of the restaurant.
Oh, the actors.
I don't get it. I did voice, dance, movement, 2 callbacks for guys and dolls. I still can't get a part.
Yeah, well, maybe you don't have any talent. Hey, that's my creme brulee.
I don't have any talent. Who are you, Tom Cruise?
On Law & Order, you don't always see the shootings. You just see the aftermath. And you get the experience of the people who are in the next room over or down the street or in the other part of the train. And here we get this guy working in a tux in the back of the restaurant complaining to the other guy about he's done voice, dance, movement, 2 callbacks for Guys and Dolls, and he still can't get a part. This is this guy's life story right here in a sentence, you know?
Mm.
And then the other guy just sort of wisecracks, well, maybe you don't have any talent, which I just thought was extremely rich coming from this show, which spent 20 years hiring every working actor in New York for parts like these.
Yeah. It's really meta when you think about it.
It was extremely meta. It was just like, you know, all of these people who come on and do these bit parts, like, what are they now saying about them?
Well, here's a little bit of nostalgia. Manuel ran a travel agency. Remember those?
Yeah.
Before the internet. Man, the profit margin on a business that can afford that office and 2 apartments and a place in Sag Harbor, no wonder they hate Expedia.
And, you know, when I was watching this back, it occurred to me that the people in these episodes from like season 1, season 2, season 3, You know, some of them ended up with sentences of like 20 to 25 years in prison. They're out now.
Yeah.
That's how old these episodes are.
Absolutely.
You know, if anybody in this episode got a 25 year prison sentence, they'd be out in what, like 2017. So
yeah.
Like they're old news, you know, they're rehabilitated.
They can imagine 2017. They were like, who's president?
Yeah.
Well, this is a rather complicated setup. You've got basically a chase that keeps going in circles with the detectives always like one step behind figuring out what's going on or finding their hitman. But they feel like they caught a break when they find the gun used to kill Abraham Lincoln.
Not before they find, by the way, the framed photo of a man's car.
So Manuel not only takes care of mom, he takes care of himself. Brand new Porsche.
Who frames a photo of their car? That's what I want to know. Did anyone else notice that, Brady? Like,
yeah.
When you bought your new minivan, when you had, like, your 20th kid, or how many kids you have now, did you frame a photo of your minivan and put it in your home? Did you or did you not do that?
I did not do that. I do own a bunch of frames, but I have not had time to put anything in the frames.
Mm.
That's sort of where I'm at. Maybe that's just another one of those generational differences. Maybe in the
yeah.
90s, people just had so much time, you know, because the Cold War was over. They didn't have anything to worry about. So they're like, I know, I'll just take pictures of my car.
Well, you got to remember, at this point, you take a picture of your car, but then you'd have to take that film down to CVS, and then you check
photo match.
Then you check the box whether you want double prints or you want another roll of film for free, and then you have to come back in a week and go through and, you know, double prints. You put some aside, and then you take the one that you like, and then you put it in the frame that you got at Sears, and then you'd put it up. And now you just put it on your phone. Brady, you know, Soretta did not actually come for money. Because he calls it a Porsche.
Porsche, yeah. I love that.
What do you call it, Kevin?
It's a Porsche.
Yeah. When I was growing up on Long Island, we called it a Porsche. It's also sort of like a New York thing, you know? It really is. Although we were all trash, so there's that too.
All right, let's take a look at our cast. Let's start with our Hey, It's That Girl.
Hey, it's that girl.
Can you tell us who's playing the girlfriend, Sandra Alvaro?
10, 12 years ago in Bogota, I knew him as a boy. Our parents played tennis together. I just gave him a place to sleep.
She was a detective on Miami Vice.
Yes. The actress's name is Sandra Santiago. She was Detective Gina Calabrese on Miami Vice. She had an on and off thing with Crockett. Her job was mostly posing as a prostitute and then locating the paperwork, just like Profaci.
Oh, Profaci.
Wait, which one was Crockett? Was that Don Johnson? That was Don Johnson, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Sandra Santiago is a trained singer.
Nice.
And she never put out her own album, but unfortunately, we can't say the same for Don Johnson or Philip Michael Thomas.
Yeah, true.
I've heard that whole album, and you're not wrong.
The whole thing? Not just
Heartbeat?
Singles?
Not just Heartbeat. No, it's...
Wow, the whole thing. Brady's a completist, if nothing else.
I got to go for the grand effect. I got to say, it's a toss-up between the record that Bruce Willis did and this one.
I forgot about Bruce
Willis. I actually had the Bruce Willis album. Respect yourself.
That one, yes.
I think we probably just got kicked off of Spotify. So if you hear this episode on Spotify, thank God. Look, Cassandra would later appear on The Sopranos as Tony's neighbor, Jean, and her twin sister, Joan.
Good for her.
You can get paid double on that one. We do have a Hey, It's That Guy.
Hey, it's that guy.
Who's the actor playing the gun dealer, George Lebrano?
You got the money, all the money. Let me see it. I got to see it first. Put it out here. Let me see.
I don't know what his name is, but I know he's the bell ding, ding, ding guy from Breaking Bad.
Right. His name is Mark Margolis. Nominated for an Emmy as Hector Salamanca on Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. You know his face, but like I said, you remember it attached to the bell on his wheelchair he used to communicate. Look, in 2017, he had an accident on the set of Better Call Saul. He had a fall which required brain surgery to relieve some swelling.
Really?
Yeah, he made a full recovery, but, you know, he was already doing most of his acting from in the wheelchair, mm-hmm. so I mean, he wasn't allowed to running around. It was probably...
It's convenient.
Convenient for, you know, for his recovery, and he's still kicking it. He had a chance to take out Gus Fring.
Yeah.
He did that.
Gus Fring.
What is it?
Fring.
Gus Fring, yeah.
Fring.
Fring.
Yes.
Who's Gus Fring?
I don't know. Gus Fring is the character on Better Call Saul. I'm terrible with names, and
he did get a chance to do that. He didn't get to take out Paul Sorvino.
Right.
He also had a chance of taking out Scarface in the movie there. He was the one who had the detonator ready to blow up the car, Brady, but he just, I forget what happened to him.
But can we just say one thing before we get to that?
Yeah.
He actually manages to look older in this episode than he does in Breaking Bad, which was filmed like, what, 25 years later?
Yeah. He looks like Jeff Dunham's old man puppet. That guy.
Sort of like a very late career Lee Van Cleef in this episode.
Looks like he's about to die.
what a range, though. I mean, you know, he's best known for this role in the Breaking Bad universe, you know, where, like, he kind of keeps everybody waiting in the bell scene. And here he's, you know, he's basically just like Coke bender agitated, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a 30 second scene. Like, you here for the gun that I want to sell you? And then, like, he shoots Sorvino and, like, says like 7,000 words in between those two things. So he's really kind of flying off the walls the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, he was in Oz, which also co-starred.
What's his face? Chris Maloney.
And? J.K. Simmons.
Oh, of course.
Who was?
I never actually.
Who was?
Skoda. I never. See, the whole thing is, you always forget I never actually saw Oz. We only talk about it on this show. I feel like I've seen Oz through the lens of this show.
Well, just pay attention because it's going to come up every once in a while. Who recognized the actor playing Frank Hoover, the defense attorney for our courthouse shooter?
Will a jury be weeping over the scum you painted as a monster? I don't think the publicity windmill is exactly blowing in your direction.
That actor's name is Lonnie Price. He's probably best known as Neil Kellerman, the would-be suitor to Jennifer Grey in Dirty Dancing.
Shut it.
Yeah.
Oh, that douche.
Yeah, he hasn't really had a breakout hit acting, but he has won two Emmy Awards for directing. He was on PBS's Great Performances. It was for Sweeney Todd and a Sondheim birthday concert.
Well, good for... Oh, that's the one with Neil Patrick Harris.
Yeah, see? Yeah. No one puts Lonnie in a corner.
Okay, forget what I said about that first guy's range. When you can go from playing Jennifer Grey's boyfriend, a suitor guy, in Dirty Dancing and then direct Great Performances on PBS, that's range.
That is range.
He has so many like non-steps to Lenny Briscoe, like in his career. It's really kind of incredible when you think about it.
Well, that he like beats him to the Law and Order by one half episode.
And then he also puts Baby in a corner.
Then he does put Baby in a corner. Like there was a successful actor sitting in the back of the courtroom. Didn't have any lines. Could barely see him over the shoulder, but I just wanted to point him out. One of the spectators in the courtroom was Andre Rojo. He'd go on to play Bubbles, the street junkie on The Wire.
Oh, yeah.
Remember him? And he's had 60 appearances as Terrence Howard's lawyer in Empire. He'd have 100 appearances if he'd been Jesse Smollett's lawyer.
Very funny.
Did you spot the guy playing Gitan's defense attorney, Chris Minetti?
I love that guy. I don't know. I don't know who he is, but I love that guy.
I don't care what that court did. It's wrong. You can't have a witness that I can't cross-examine.
That gentleman is Joe Lissy. 10 Law & Order franchise appearances. If you were a fan of Third Watch, you'd know him as Lieutenant Skorsky, who ran the 55th Precinct for 6 seasons.
I loved Third Watch, by the way.
Loved Third Watch?
Oh, my God. I loved it.
So did you recognize him?
Nope.
Yeah. You loved it a lot, apparently. Look, he was a New York Police Department captain who retired after 24 years and then became an actor. He made his Broadway debut at age 52. His resume has him listed as playing a cop 19 times.
Wow.
And one time as the teacher in the ABC after school special High School Narc.
Save your theatrics, man. Save your theatrics.
High School Narc, whose message taught kids, be careful who you buy your drugs from. So Logan has this theory that because Gaetan likes to shoot left-handed, that he'd want a gun that ejects the cartridges the opposite way. So they use the name of a con who'd buy guns, and they start calling illegal dealers, and Soretta gets a guy on the line, and he answers the question by saying,
I'm a friend of Tommy's. What, do I sound like a cop?
I don't know. All the typewriters going on behind you, the guy at the other desk also asking for dealers. I don't know. You tell me.
Never mind the other person asking the same questions right next to me.
Probably should have tipped that gun dealer off when he heard somebody come behind them yelling, has anybody seen the LUDs I'm looking for?
So, man, there are 10 million guns in the Naked City, but just none like the ones ever used by the people in this episode.
Correct.
It was a big stretch, yeah. Do you happen to have this one gun that was just involved in a high-profile killing at a restaurant that everyone in New York is supposedly talking about? Oh, yes, I have two of them. Would you like one? I'll only sell it to you for $3,500 to $4,000.
We'll work out the details of that later.
There's a great detail. Soretta feels like he has to buff his nails to meet with a gun dealer. Because if the gun dealer can't see his own reflection in his nails, he'll know he's a cop. Like, what the actual fuck? Brady, do you do that before you meet with cops?
I don't really buff my nails really for anybody. Except for myself.
The takedown of the drug dealer that they first call Elvis because he got slick back hair, and then is later we know him as Gaitan, who later says that he's Pablo Esteban. Anyway, when they take him out, they decided they're going to lure him back to Sandra's apartment, and they have six SWAT teams, four here, two across the street, and the way they contact Logan is by calling him on a cell phone, which is the size of a brick.
Zach Morris.
Yeah. Zach, and he just pulls it out of nowhere.
Yeah, Logan. Okay, thanks. Sandra just took the call.
Meantime, Cragen's got a walkie-talkie that's the size of his hand. Who dialed the seven numbers and said, oh, he's coming. Okay, hey, I think I see him. All right. 2-0-2-5.
Sorry, your call cannot be completed as dialed.
Did you, like me, Brady, like have a total spit take laugh your ass off moment when out of frame he pulls the Zach Morris phone and puts it to his ear?
I almost fell out of my chair as I was like, wait, where did that come from? You know, it would have been less surprising if he had like pulled an elephant out of his pocket.
Yeah. Or if he'd used that giant cell phone any other time in the series. It was obviously lent to him. So once Logan has this idea that maybe, you know, the bullet casing trail is backwards, that it would mean that it was a different kind of weapon, they end up going to the book.
Yeah.
A 223 automatic. Who makes it?
Stair-Aug Commando, 223, Austrian. High velocity, virtually no recoil, adjustable ejector left or right.
Ah, here's the gun. And then it just sort of turns it sideways and it's like Gun Digest, which is apparently the yellow pages of guns.
The police department's every gun ever book.
Yeah. That's right.
It was right next to the Sea Monkeys advertisement. So the writers knew that Paul Sorvino was going to be leaving the show, so they wrote this scene first and then built the story out around that the rest of the episode.
Really?
Yeah.
It's so complicated.
Well, maybe that's why.
Why can't they just have this party for him and like that's the episode?
You never see anybody just like, oh, you know what? I've decided to move on. You know, I'm pursuing other opportunities. Or my wife got a job in Texas, so we're moving there next month. No, it has to be something horrible and tragic.
I think only Angie Harmon got the I got a new job departure. Everyone else had something a little
probably
more dramatic.
Just across the street.
Yeah, just across the street. We can have these walking salads whenever we want.
They didn't with Sorvino, they didn't play the Serena Sutherland card, you know, where the like Captain Cragen sits him down and says, sorry, Phil, this isn't working out. And he goes, is this because I'm a lesbian?
Is this because I'm a lesbian?
No, she's not a lesbian.
They could say it's definitely not because you're a lesbian.
As a matter of fact, it is not, Phil.
Yeah. So when the writers wrote this scene, they didn't want like the suave criminal and the suave cop, like one of those kinds of undercover scenes where everybody's really cool. They wanted them both to be nervous so that we would be nervous. And I got to say, I think that this scene is pretty shocking.
It's not okay. You should like it. You don't like it. You ought to be paying more. You got the extra 500. Come up with it now. It's a good buy.
It's fine. It's fine.
You want to be Mr. 10%? Here's your 10%.
Well, what's shocking about it is that Sorvino, after being shot twice in the gut, managed Teddy Roosevelt style, still grab the guy and fucking take him down.
No, that was Logan.
I don't know.
Sorvino just fell to the corner.
No. Paul Sorvino actually also like had a moment where he was like still with it. It was, I thought, pretty exciting.
He sort of held him in place. Like he couldn't really do anything except just like put his weight on the guy.
Yes, he was a
bookend. And then like by then, Logan was able to I'm sorry, come out of the closet. And then...
Yes. Forgot Logan was actually hiding in the closet. Yes.
And then they were able... And then, like, you know...
Who thought Logan was the lesbian?
Sort of, you know... And then kind of from the hallway, then like Kragen and the Pussycats all run in and then, like, you know, swarm, and then everybody's screaming. Oh, they all stop screaming just long enough for Soretta to make his big statement, you know, as he's starting to pass out.
Phil, 30 years, charmed life. I never even fired. I can't breathe.
And then he goes,
yeah, he starts doing that spasm. It's weird.
And then it's like, I'm just going to be in the hospital and everything's going to be fine. It's very anticlimactic.
Honestly, and maybe this is because I watch too much old TV, but like when they came back from the commercial break and then it's like Logan and Kragen and Robinette all hanging out at the hospital, I started thinking of Seinfeld when they're all waiting to find out about Susan and the toxic envelopes, you know? This was supposed to be the summer of Soretta.
That's right.
The summer of Soretta. Hey, look, in 20 years, though, I mean, I think we can count the on-screen shootings of our main characters.
Can we?
On one hand.
Really?
Over 20 seasons.
All right, so count and go ahead.
Max Greeby.
Mary, Mother of God!
The shooting here with Servino. Ed Green got shot.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It ain't none of my business, Kenny, but you ever think about not getting any underside?
No, never entered my mind.
Yo, Kenny!
So he could go off and make rent. Let's see, there was someone who shot at Bernardo and Lupo, right? There was a scene in the hallway.
Police! Get down! Get down! Police, stay down!
For a cop show, right? Which is sort of built on chases and sirens and gunfire. Law and Order didn't have a lot of that. And this happened really fast.
Yeah.
It was...
Which is how it actually happens, probably, right?
It was not telegraphed. You just pulled the gun real fast, shot him. I thought it was shocking. Rebecca, I watched you watch this, and you went, oh, shit.
Yeah. But yeah, no, that actually was very, very shocking. I don't think I've ever seen this episode before. When I did, it was literally the year I graduated high school. So yeah, I was very surprised to see a famous actor who I knew had been on the show just surprised get shot in the gut by wheelchair bell guy out of nowhere. It was actually, I thought, kind of cool because it's actually the way sometimes violence goes down. It's not expected. It's not telegraphed. It just happens.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Save big money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
All right, now let's take a look at the second half of this episode. Soretta's alive, but he may have spinal damage. And the arrest of gun dealer Lebrano for shooting a cop only makes their case against the hitman more complicated.
I'm not saying we'll plead him, Mike, but if you can identify Guy Tom.
Let me ask you something. If the son of a bitch had shot Stone, would you even think of pleading? My partner might spend the rest of his life on wheels. You want Lebrano, too bad.
Schiff says that the feds want to cut Gaetan a deal to testify in their drug cases, but Stone still wants to try him for murder. They need Lebrano, and Soretta blesses their decision to cut him a deal for his cooperation. The defense says the man on trial is truly Paulo Esteban, but Manuel's mother says no, he's Javier Gaetan, El Diablo, the Prince of Darkness. Stone plays hardball with girlfriend Sandra, getting a statement incriminating Gaetan. But after a mysterious jailhouse phone call, she changes her mind. After referencing more obscure case law to advance the plot, they just read her deposition in open court. So dramatic.
Mm.
The jury finds Gaetan guilty, and as he leaves before sentencing, he's gunned down in front of the courthouse. No es posible.
Si es posible.
Si es posible. The Colombian Jack Ruby is Mr. Cristobal. Mr. Cristobal, like crystal ball.
Cristobal.
Well, you need a crystal ball to find out that it's...
That's true.
Yeah, okay. Mr. Cristobal, he's distraught over El Diablo's murder of his son back home. Robinette offers generous terms for a guilty plea, but Cristobal asks for time to put his affairs in order. Lebrano steps in and says that Cristobal... No, they got it right. I got it right that time. Cristobal is a fake. That he's also a Colombian hitman and he's jumped bail. Schiff gets a call saying both gun dealer Lebrano and Manuel's business partner were killed in prison, and Manuel's mother fell out a window. And when asked what happened to Manuel's little daughter, Schiff says, well, she got picked up at school by her uncle. But Stone says, she doesn't have an uncle. So out of 456 episodes, IMDb users rank this episode as the 11th best episode of all time. Law & Order superfan Charlie Pierce of Esquire says this is his favorite, or this is the best episode. And after years of trying, and not joking here, trying to get Charlie Pierce to come on and talk about this episode.
You mean like, wait, don't tell me it's Charlie
Pierce?
Yes. Okay.
He still stood us up. So we had to say, okay, I guess we'll call Brady.
Yeah.
And Brady said yes.
Brady can probably do Charlie Pierce if we want him to.
This sort of makes up, I know Charlie Pierce once had to fill in on very short notice for another wait, don't tell me panelist. So that now he's like even cosmically.
Yeah, yes. That's it. But I will say this is a great episode, but it's a bleak episode.
Well, so there comes a point in this episode where everyone who tells on a person or does something to a person is also killed. Mm-hmm. So I was like, this is just a carousel of killing. One person goes in and testifies and they come out of the courtroom steps and they're killed. So some witness to that killing goes into the courthouse and testifies and then they come out and they're killed. I did feel a little bit like I was on a carousel of death written by Shirley Jackson at some point during this episode. Brady, did you find yourself thinking like, we're just on a sushi conveyor belt of death during this episode?
It really felt that way the whole time. I mean, this is something that in the early days of Law & Order, they loved to do. One of the big Law & Order tropes was the super scary, super efficient, incredibly ruthless foreign mob. I mean, I think of the episode in the next
others.
Season. Yeah, well, I mean, they do kind of other these people, but...
The Russian mob.
The Russian mob that winds up killing Allison Janney off. Sorry, anybody who hasn't watched season 4. But the Russian mob that killed Allison Janney in season 4.
It's just spoiler alert from 30 years ago. Yeah.
which gave the writers the excuse for Ben Stone to resign.
Oh, thank God.
And had nothing to do...
Hallelujah.
Had nothing to do with Janet Reno.
It was the Russian mob all along. They were interfering even on Law and Order.
Well, okay, let's start with Serretta for a second. His storyline doesn't officially close until the next episode. This is when Briscoe is already teamed with Logan. And, of course, they start off, they don't like each other.
Of course.
You know, Logan, I don't have any problems with your jinx.
Is that so?
Hey, two partners shot? A lot of guys would say you're a black cat. The fact is, my ex-wives are both thrilled I got this. They're under the mistaken impression that I'm heavily insured.
Hey, Briscoe, don't forget it's a temp job.
Briscoe's character is a little bit, he's using ethnic slurs and everybody thinks he's dirty and he's not really
he
the lovable
Briscoe.
Like,
a wad of cash in his pocket, right?
Oh, you're thinking of...
Green. Oh, no, I'm thinking of What's-His-Face.
Green wished he had a load
no,
of
No, I'm thinking of What's-His-Face.
His
white mustache guy, my favorite actor of
Joe
all time.
Fontana.
From the entire Law and Order universe.
Yes.
J-Lo's dad from Out of Sight.
So later on, we'll see Logan visit Serretta in the hospital, and he explains that there's some nerve damage to his legs.
I'm not going to be in the street with you anymore. What I'm saying is that even with the physical therapy and everything, as your partner, I wouldn't be 100%.
Hey, now, wait a minute, Phil. Any percent you give is enough.
Not for me.
And he's been offered a desk job at the 110... And now Logan can move on and accept Lenny as his new partner. Now, when Briscoe retired, when we did the Briscoe retire episode, we did talk about Paul Sorvino, who according to Paul Sorvino, is one of the seven greatest living actors.
And the one of the seven most likely to tell you that he's in that company.
Yeah, yeah. He didn't like how cold New York was, so he thought he was going to lose his opera voice. Mm. And Brady started wearing that Russian Cossack hat. He just brought it to the set.
I love that hat.
Yeah.
I do love the scene when he's in the hospital and Logan doesn't want him to agree that they're going to make the deal with the gun dealer, George Lobrano. And then he sort of explains why he's okay with it. He goes, Mike,
I can walk. I can talk. I can. All the important things.
All the important things. Like,
yeah, fuck. He was talking about fucking.
Okay, so we're all in agreement. That's what he was saying without just outright saying it.
I don't know how he tested that. Did he have a nurse come over?
But can we just say this was the real tribute to Paul Sorvino? They did not fucking need Soretta's permission. It was a show. Like, the whole thing was, it's not like the DA needs to actually get the cop's permission whether or not to put this guy on the stand or not. It was really just an opportunity for them to go to Paul Sorvino and for him to give his blessing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting there, I was like, Logan was like, you don't have to do this, man. I'm like, no, you don't, because they could just go ahead and like do that anyway without your permission.
If Jack McCoy was in the ADA spot at that point, like he would have just gone ahead and done it.
Oh,
like
yeah.
Stone, of course, is Mr. Bleeding Heart, and like, oh, I want to check with everybody first.
Well,
but yeah, McCoy was just like,
you
know, you can just sit there and recover. I'm going to take care of business.
Yeah. It's also a chance for Michael Moriarty to come in and have a scene with Paul Sorvino where, again, he doesn't look at him. He's just looking at the pie plate that they put up off camera.
I feel like you need to explain that every time. Like,
sorry, that's what Michael Moriarty did.
But like, the context is, people who have not listened to that particular episode, Michael Moriarty was so weird that he wouldn't look at people because he felt like they were stealing his soul.
That's right, which is why when you see him talk to somebody and he's looking at their forehead, he is actually just looking at their forehead. He doesn't want to make the eye contact.
And actors became so uncomfortable with that they would have a stand-in that was literally a pie plate on a stick. And that's what he would be acting to. The best. The best story I've ever heard from behind the scenes in my entire career doing podcasts about TV.
Real talk. Pie plate on a stick, not the worst actor they've ever had on this franchise.
Yeah, that's true. That's
not
true.
Even close.
Was the pie plate a lesbian, though? That's the real question.
A lesbian pie plate.
Well, did Fred Thompson's character fire it? If
not, why? No, 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 no. So Sandra won't testify that Gaetan visited her apartment before the hit, and she's afraid of the cartel, right?
She should be.
Well, sure.
I mean, they fucking kill everyone.
Yeah. She's the only one alive outside of the DA's office and the police precinct at the end of the episode. She's it. Last woman standing, folks.
Well, Stone, again, it was just Michael Moriarty staring at a pie plate. He threatens to release her from jail and then announce they have a witness so that the bad guys will think that she's a snitch.
He's in a hurry. Press conference. We're announcing a new prosecution witness expected to solidify our case.
What's your friend Gaetan going to think when you get out of jail?
This is not you, Ben.
This is definitely me, Sally. When a cop gets shot building a case, I want a conviction.
He threatens her with the appearance of cooperation in order to get her cooperation.
Correct. Like, there's so many fucking civil rights violations in this episode. Along with, like, just the stupid decisions. Like, by the way, the cartel also made a fucking stupid decision by murdering people who weren't actually witnesses and like letting the actual witness just like go?
Like, like, so if they already had decisions. A Colombian hitman in New York, why do they have to fly Gaetan up just so that they could have to kill him later too?
Yes, they had Mr. Fake Dad there. They could have just gone with that guy.
He could have gone to the restaurant. He didn't need a fucking left-handed machine gun. So a judge in Mr. Cristobal's case makes well, the judge makes a surprise ruling.
We ask the court to release Mr. Cristobal 2 days before the final sentencing so that he may say goodbye to his family and put his affairs in order.
Mr. Robinette.
Mr. Cristobal confessed to a homicide, Your Honor.
And a terrible crime it is. Do you know what they say, Mr. Robinette? Do unto others?
Everyone makes a big deal that she let a confessed killer walk out of the courthouse, but he's going to jail because they let a convicted killer walk out of the courthouse before sentencing.
Hmm.
So, like, fool me once?
That's why he wears the black robes, Kevin.
That's why he wears the black robes. So in the final scene, Schiff gets the longest phone call in the history of Law and Order.
Literally.
Yes.
I timed it 25 seconds.
They're usually six.
Mm-hmm.
25 seconds of us waiting and waiting for what is going on.
Not an accident? Thanks.
There is this Godfather-like string of coordinated hits on everyone involved.
The gun dealer was in the yard at Riker's. Had his throat cut. Buenaventura was strangled in the kitchen at Dannemora. Manuel Ortega's mother fell out of a window.
What about the little girl?
She was picked up at school by her uncle.
She doesn't have an uncle.
And so instead of getting three separate phone calls every time somebody died, someone said, hey, wait, before we call the DA, let's see if something else happens. Maybe I can just make this one phone call.
No, no, don't call him yet. There's still like three more witnesses.
Yeah, let's try to give him some good news. Oh, you got the gun dealer too? Oh, shit.
But not the jurors who actually...
At least grandma's okay.
But not the jurors who actually proclaimed him guilty, right?
Yeah, they're all fine, too.
I was like, why do people keep standing up for these people? The judge is, like, being sassy. The jurors are being sassy. I'm like, oh, my God, all these guys are going to be dead. They're all going to be dead. But no, it was just people who... And this is my question. Brady, can I ask you a question about this episode?
Of course.
So the young daughter, who we found at the very end in the blackout scene, has been picked up by school by her, quote, uncle, which apparently she doesn't have, and we're supposed to infer that she's dead, right, Kevin?
Yes.
The daughter witnessed the shooting of her parents by a guy who is now dead. What possible threat does this, like, 11-year-old pose to a Colombian cartel?
And if they were just going to pick her up with a fake uncle, why didn't he just shoot her then?
They're polite. It's all about sending a message.
Yeah.
It's about sending a message.
She was too young then, but a couple of weeks later after the trial and everything, then now she's old enough.
They're letting her ripen.
Yeah.
Like a banana.
Ew. Putting her in the freezer so I can make a smoothie with her later.
My favorite scene in this whole episode is the phone call scene. Schiff is just grunting for like 30 seconds on network television.
25 seconds. I timed it. 25 seconds.
Stephen Hill is famous for, he'd get his script and he'd tell the writers he had too many lines, you know, which
yes.
How many actors do that? He'd be like, no, I want less dialogue. My character doesn't talk. And I mean, this is like the big dramatic reveal of everything that this episode has led up to. And he's just grunting for almost a half a minute. And then he just goes, not an accident. And then all of a sudden, everybody in the room, like, they perk up and they're trying to figure out what people are saying to him on the phone. But it's such a great performance.
All I will say is I will actually compare Stephen Hill to one of my other favorite TV actors who disdains every line they're given and everybody in every scene they're with, which is Shannon Doherty. To me, Shannon Doherty's whole vibe on Beverly Hills 90210 is, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, and I hate everything I have to say. Stephen Hill, as you always say, Kevin, fucking hates everything he has to say, both as a character and as an actor, and who appears to hate everything about his job, both in real life and on screen. Yes or no?
Yes. Yes. And then phone call, he's like, oh, Jesus. Why couldn't someone throw me out the fucking door?
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
All right, let's take a look at the real-life story that inspired this episode. It's time for Ripped from the Headlines.
You think you know who did it.
You think you know who did it.
But you don't know who did it.
You don't know who did it. Ripped from the Headlines.
This episode takes cues from characters from the real-life Colombian drug war of the 1990s. The hitman in this story is loosely based on the most infamous Colombian enforcer of them all, John Jairo Velasquez. He was known by the nickname Popeye because he looked so much like the cartoon character Popeye. After dropping out of several military and police academies, Velasquez became the personal hitman for drug lord Pablo Escobar of the ruthless Medellin drug cartel. Velasquez is credited with more than 250 killings, many of them politicians, police officers, and military officials who got in the way of their cocaine operation. During his time with the cartel, Velasquez is said to have kidnapped a future Colombian president, a future vice president, and murdered a governor and a presidential candidate. He even killed his own wife when it was discovered she became a police informant. In 1992, Velasquez surrendered to justice officials and was sentenced to 30 years in prison. He was released on probation in 2014 and made news telling tales about his days as a drug hitman.
Okay, Popeye Velasquez died in February 2020 of esophageal cancer.
R.I.P.
R.I.P. Popeye. He studied how to give manicures and pedicures as a young man, which must be where he learned to be comfortable with inflicting pain. Brady's had, a pedicure once in his life.
Pedicures don't hurt. Have you ever actually had one? They don't hurt. Maybe they hurt you because your calluses were intense. But
man, Brady, I think like when they cut your nails, they cut them way too close, right?
Half of this episode has been about my nails. I feel like I should post a picture or something now.
Yes. Hey. Can I see my face in them? That's the question.
Yes. Look, they called him Popeye because he looked like the cartoon character. Not because he had the bulky forearms with the anchor tattoos, but he had the big protruding chin.
That's just mean.
It's mean?
That's like a mean thing to call you Popeye for. I'm just saying.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to make a hitman upset. I'm sure the plastic surgery made him less scary. Velasquez kidnapped, as I said, a future president of Colombia, the future vice president, killed a governor, a presidential candidate, a police colonel, and planted a bomb on an airplane that killed 110 people. Brady, if something is worth doing, it's worth doing well.
I just read one of those pieces of dad wisdom the other day that, you know, you do what you should first and then you do what you want. I don't know. Does he subscribe to that? Is that?
I think he might be doing what he wants first.
That may be, yeah.
I'm not 100, though, because it also seems like he did accomplish the goals, right? He's very efficient.
I mean,
if the goal was to make people scared of you and kill people, like, he's kind of good at that. A++, Popeye.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that would mean that people are not interested in him. Mm. They're afraid of him. He has an official website.
He does.
Yeah, he did anyway. It's elpopeye.com.
Shut the fuck up.
He also ran a YouTube channel where he commented on Colombian current events.
From prison?
No, we got out of prison.
Oh, so he got like a 1991 sentence, like this
right,
episode.
Right, he was released in 2014.
How did you get released after you planted a bomb in an airplane that killed 110 people?
People like Popeye, I don't know.
Just the idea of like, I mean, just having watched this episode and thinking like, if that character had lived and then decades later, you know, he had gone from being known as the Prince of Darkness, El Diablo, to the guy who says, "Hey guys, don't forget to smash that subscribe button like I smashed the former president of my country."
Yes.
It's just, I mean, whoa.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. That's the way to do it.
I mean, that's reinventing yourself.
And like in the 2000s, we know, like, not to get dark or anything, but if you just know somebody, if you're not American and you know somebody who said they might possibly put a bomb on a plane that killed 110 people, like, you're going to Guantanamo Bay, like, forever. Mm. Extrajudicial, like, horrible sentencing. This guy had a website and a fan group and a YouTube channel. I mean, I gotta say, like, I am pro, criminal justice reform. So, like, I'm disgusted, but also kind of proud of Popeye, I gotta say.
Well, if you remember earlier in the episode, I said that Charlie Pierce, the magazine writer, identified this as his favorite episode. And I have tried for a couple of years to get his attention to come on. So I will say that Cy Frater originally recorded this a long time ago. So long that Popeye was alive.
Wow.
When he did it. So we had to cut out the last sentence.
Nice.
Which, so let's see, what did it say? I forget what it said. Today, Popeye Velasquez operates a YouTube channel where he comments on current events. He doesn't do that anymore. He has died. He did have almost 2 million followers.
Shit!
On YouTube.
That was monetizable in a big way.
Yeah. Meantime, the These Are Their Stories YouTube channel has 6 subscribers.
Yes. Do we even have a YouTube channel? Like, why do we have that?
Well, it's just in case.
So can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Are you going to use this episode to try to entice Charlie Pierce to be on a future episode and be like, look what you missed, dude?
Yeah, look what you missed, Charlie. Suck it. That is going to do it for us. We want to thank our special guest, Charlie Pierce fill-in Brady Carlson. Brady, where can our listeners follow you online?
You can find me at my website, bradycarlson.com, or my podcast website, coolweirdawesome.com, which I think actually redirects to my website. So just either one is fine.
And Rebecca Lavoie, where can our listeners follow you?
Well, they can follow me at Reb Lavoie, or they can just watch the Tom Clancy movie Clear and Present Danger and also get another version of this Law & Order episode. But no, I'm at Reb Lavoie on Instagram and Twitter.
And you can track me on Twitter at Kevin P. Flynn, and you can also tweet to us at Law & Order Pod, or follow us on Instagram at These Are Their Stories Podcast. Our newsreader was Cy Frater. Our theme music was composed and performed by Uncanny Valleys. Line editing by Henry Lavoie. Content assistance from Travis Roy. Billy Flynn handles promotions. To get ad-free episodes of These Are Their Stories a week early, sign up for Stitcher Premium. All clips in this podcast were used in compliance with the U.S. Copyrights Act Fair Use Exemption for criticism and commentary. Go to lawandorderpodcast.com. or Law & Order Pod, or These Are Their Stories Podcast.com. We own them all. And sign up for our newsletter for a chance to be our next Law & Order Marathon winner. These Are Their Stories was recorded in the Yoga Loft above the Bodega in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi studio, and is a production of Partners in Crime Media.
Partners in Crime Media.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.